and welcome to Higher Ed, KUT's podcast focusing on issues of higher education, lifelong learning, and exercising the brain. I'm Jennifer Staton with KUT 90.5, Austin's NPR station, talking as always with Dr. Ed Berger, president of Southwestern University in Georgetown, Texas. Hello, Ed.
Well, happy Sunday to you, Jennifer.
Happy Sunday to you. Always glad to be chatting about issues around education and learning and higher ed.
And silliness.
And where all of those realms meet. we've been hearing from listeners a lot these days. Yeah. We've been getting lots of emails. People emailing me at jstayton, S-T-A-Y-T-O-N, at KUT.org with ideas of things they'd like to hear us talk about.
And I wonder which is more kind of remarkable, that they're sending in their comments or that we have listeners at all.
I think
it's a push.
I think both of those things are wonderful, and I'm very happy about them. So
someone wrote something.
Yeah. So Rebecca sent in an email to me, and she had read an article in the Atlantic that was about grade inflation.
Oh yes, I saw that.
Now the article, I may be mispronouncing the author's name. Ina Katsikas is the author of the article, and I just want to read a couple sentences from it to kind of get us all on the same page. It's raining A's in America's higher education system, and not necessarily because students are particularly smart. In fact, many of them probably don't deserve the high marks they're getting. They have grade inflation to thank. That inflation is rapidly spreading to higher education institutions across the country. Despite stagnant academic performance, more students than ever before receive grades higher grades than they should. The trend is raising ethical questions and marks a 180 flip from a few decades ago when the opposite problem, grade deflation, plagued many colleges. So what Rebecca asked was, if grades no longer represent what we learned or the effort that was put into the class, then what is the purpose of grades? And if we were to throw them out, how do we ensure that a student is learning? So there's a lot in there.
There's a lot in there.
Prompted by this documented phenomenon of grade inflation.
First of all, I must say, I've been in education now for 30 years, and I've never seen the opposite problem of grade deflation. I've never seen that.
Interesting.
This is like the arms race where grades just keep going up and up at institutions until they make a concerted effort to pull them down and kind of start all over again, and then they start to creep up again. First of all, it brings up an interesting philosophical question, which is what do grades mean and what are they used for?
Uh-huh.
I mean, these are what schools, law schools and medical schools use to admit students. So obviously they want high grades. And so it then puts pressure on potentially some faculty members to make sure that, their students who are talented, get into those things. I've always thought of grades personally. Now I'm speaking as an educator.
Mm-hmm.
As I think of myself as like Walter Cronkite, I'm just reporting the news.
Okay.
So I never give a grade. Like someone says, I'm going to give you an A. I'm not going to give you anything, Jennifer. You're going to earn an A or you're going to earn a B and you're going to earn a C. But then, of course, the next comment that someone will make is, but you determine what they earned. And so in some sense, you are, in some sense, giving them a grade because you're at least, setting that or it's going through your lens. Now, mathematics, it's a little different than like some of the humanities and social sciences where there's a lot of room for interpretation. But even so in mathematics, a proof can be not quite correct, but you give that person an A or a B or a C on that proof. How do you measure that?
Because you're measuring sort of effort intent versus just the flat, did they get it right or wrong?
And not only just effort, but if it's wrong, is it wrong for good reasons? I mean, is it a good, are there good mistakes and then there are bad mistakes? And sometimes good mistakes are very creative. We talked about failure, mm-hmm. and effective failure. Sometimes the most creative things come out of a mistake. And if they're making those kind of requisite mistakes, then you want to reward that to some degree, even though it's still not right, versus just someone who spent hours upon hours banging their head against the wall and really have done nothing.
So Rebecca raised an interesting question, which is given the fact that grade inflation has been documented out there, this article talks about it, you've seen it, I think we've heard about it, over the years, then what is the purpose of grades if the, I hesitate to use the word value, but if the value sort of attached to them is somewhat arbitrary, is witnessed by the fact that they seem to be getting higher and higher without evidence that necessarily students are getting, in quotes, smarter, better.
Well, but I'd like to think about it from a different point of view, when you think about grades, let's think about how a grade is shaped. So let's not think about the final grade you get in my class.
Uh-huh.
Let's rather think about how that grade came to be.
Uh-huh.
Because I think this raises some real interesting issues that we can do something about, actually. With grade inflation, it's hard to do anything about. Uh-huh. But we can do something about this. So let's think about this. So you take a calculus class with me. And by the way, this is going to be hypothetical because you're a genius. But in this theoretical scenario, and let's suppose you struggle at the beginning of the class and your homework grades aren't so great, but you're working really hard. You take the first exam in my class and let's say you get like a 74. And then you take another exam, you know, later in the semester and you get an 80-something. Let's say you get an 83. And then you take my cumulative final exam and you really get it together. Everything clicks at the end and you get a 95.
Mm-hmm.
What should your grade be in that class? Well, you could average those things up, throw in your homework grades and participation. Of course, with Ed Berger, it's always quality of effective failure as 5% and see what the average is. And that's basically how I do it. But here's the issue for all of us to think about. If you end up with a 95% on a cumulative understanding of the material. So imagine that you just prove yourself at the end. Why am I punishing you because it took you a little bit longer or because you kind of struggled at the beginning? Shouldn't I be measuring kind of what you're doing as you leave that classroom door for the last time in my class versus punishing you because of the journey that was requisite? So it brings up a very thought-provoking idea about grades, which is, if grades are supposed to be measuring kind of success, however you define that, and that's a very subjective thing, maybe mm-hmm. it's just that you can do the mechanics of it or you understand it deeply or whatever it is, why don't we encourage people to continue their studies until they've mastered it? Meaning, instead of talking about grade inflation, maybe we should be talking about grade iteration. So just keep doing it. Keep doing it until you've mastered it. And if, in fact, you do that by the end of the semester, then great, and then I should reward you. And if not, then maybe you just keep taking calculus. Maybe courses shouldn't end just because the semester ends.
Actually, this leads into another discussion, and maybe that can be another episode about sort of the structure of formal education. And, you know, we seem to have an idea that, you know, in elementary school and high school, it's 6 weeks. And then all of a sudden in college, it's semesters, you know, and in some ways,
it's very artificial.
It's arbitrary and it's built around time off.
Right, exactly. And why not build the educational rubric around what you're trying to accomplish and mastery of material, mastery of thinking, mastery of creativity. And so if it takes me a little bit longer to get through calculus, maybe I finish calculus in a semester and a half, but I'm not penalized for it. I don't fail it. I finally get it. And maybe you get it within 3/4 of a semester and then you get an A and you move on. That is really now individualized education, which is very exciting. And then the grades are then truly measuring something. Basically, you don't leave the class until you get an A. So then you have lots of inflation, but now you've also raised a standard. And you're saying you don't leave until you really have true mastery, however the instructor defines true mastery. That's a different approach to education, which I find very thought-provoking.
Well, I am not sure that I have mastered the puzzler from the last episode, but
the digit one.
The digit one, but I want to give my best effort and see what my beginning grade might be.
Let me remind everyone what that was. So I gave you 4 digits.
Yep.
The numbers 2, 3, 4, and 5.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave you 2 symbols, the equal sign and the plus sign. And just using those 4 digits and those 2 symbols, you must use each of them once and no more than once.
Okay.
You cannot use any other symbols and you can't use any other numbers. The question is, can you create a correct math statement?
So I had a couple of strategic approaches. One of them I tried and it didn't really work, which is, gosh, could you combine those digits? So mm-hmm. in other words, you've got 2, 3, 4, 5, but would 34 be helpful or 42? Mm-hmm. Well, it turns out no, because that just makes a number that's way too big that you can't really do anything with.
Okay.
So I had another possibility,
yes.
But it turned out you actually needed the plus sign twice.
What was that?
Well, it turns out that 3 + 4 = 2 + 5. They both equal 7, but...
So I like that. So that's very close, right? If you had 2 + signs, you could do it, but
except,
only have the plus sign once.
Right.
But that's a true statement, though.
It's definitely true. Yes, that is definitely true.
Okay.
However, I did not follow all the guidelines to get there, so I had to toss that one out, too. So,
good. Effective failure.
Effective failure. So I'm kind of still puzzling over Except I'm wondering, does this at all hinge on, this is going to sound super technical, on like the definition of digit? So in other words, could I move around a number? Or does it have to exist in a typical placeholder as a digit? Is this getting too mathy?
No. Well, okay. No, it's not too mathy for me. And okay. The answer is no. You just have these digits. You have to, I still want you to think of like four as like, you know, like for that reason. It's the number four. You know, and two is not like, oh, that also. I mean, it's the number two and the number four and three and five.
But could it something be raised to the power of something?
No. What are you thinking? So you obviously, you're being catty here. You have some idea. Tell us what you're thinking.
So 3 squared is 9.
3 squared does equal 9.
And that is the same as 4 plus 5.
Excellent.
So that gets all the numbers in there, but I'm using the 2 as, you know, 3 squared, 3 to the second power.
But if you think about it symbolically, you used a 3.
I did.
You used a 2.
I did.
The 2 is slightly raised above and after the 3,
mm-hmm.
but no new symbol there.
Right.
You use the equal sign, you use the 4, you use the plus sign, and you use the 5. So you have a 3, you have a 2, you have an equal, you have a 4, you have a plus, and you have a 5, and it's a true math statement. Congratulations, Jennifer. You got it. 3 squared equals 4 plus 5.
Ding, ding, ding.
Excellent. Look at you.
No, I just...
A good hint I could have given people is that even though you have to use each of the digits, they don't have to be the same font size.
Oh,
because
there
when
go.
You think, when you think of exponents, they're usually a little bit smaller font,
uh-huh.
but it's still a 2.
Yep.
Good
there
for you.
Go.
Good
All
for
right.
you.
Okay. Well...
Well, I give you an A++++. Speaking of grade inflation.
Your determination of my mastery is that I got it.
Well, exactly. And then I'm inflating your grade.
Well, so I want to get back to Rebecca's question here, jumping off of the topic of grade inflation, because she had a good sort of final question, which is, so if we, you know, were to sort of dismiss grades as we know them, get rid of them, how do you then know that a student is learning? Doesn't there always have to be some measurable demonstration of knowledge, or does there?
Well, I mean, and you use two words there. You use knowledge and you use learning. And so the fundamental question here for Rebecca and for all educators is what is the goal of that class? And you have to be able to articulate that. And if it's a skill set, if it's knowledge, if it is, you know, the ability to promote certain algorithms, then you have to be able to reproduce that knowledge. If it's about a mindset or ways of looking at things or ways of interpreting things, whether it's poetry or a piece of history, then you need to be able to test that. So it really hinges on what does that learning mean. And I think that we have a diversity of courses, especially in the liberal arts, and I think we should have a diversity of definitions of what learning is in all those different fields so that we actually have this rich texture of what our education defines ourselves as.
As we wrap up here, let me toss out this wild idea
Go
to
ahead.
You. You're a college president, you're an educator.
I am both.
What if grades looked like this? What if classes where you did need a body of knowledge, I'm thinking of, say, medical school.
Right.
Where you need to know the bones and the muscles.
Correct.
What if those had components of pretty definitive measurements of progressing through the knowledge and mastering the knowledge? But philosophy, maybe we don't need grades as much there. Maybe, you know, what if the measurable activities were not uniform across all schools, all classes, all topics, all institutions? I'm just tossing that out there for discussion.
Well, I mean, it's certainly the case. I mean, in math, you get a right answer or it's wrong. I mean, it's, you know, if you solve an equation, you get the correct answer or not. So I think there's something to that. But I think that there are greater similarities in learning outcomes in some of these fields that you mentioned, philosophy and some of the biological and medical arts, for example. I mean, I think it is trying to harness ways of thinking and modes of creativity. And I think that you can be really creative philosophically and you can be really creative biologically. And the mind works differently, but the idea of generating new insights and generating new perspectives and an appreciation for a diversity of vantage points, that's something that I think persists in many of these fields. And how we measure that is one thing. But I think that, you know, in some sense, when you think really big about these fields, they actually have more in common than they actually are different,
Well, and coming up in a couple episodes, we're going to be talking about the idea of creativity. So be sure that everybody tuned in for that. That's coming up a little bit later this season. Thank you, Ed, for keeping us on our toes and helping us keep our brain sharp. Dr. Ed Berger is president of Southwestern University in Georgetown. You can find out more at southwestern.edu and keep your brain busy by keeping up with the news and other episodes of Higher Ed at KUT.org. I'm Jennifer Staton with KUT News.